This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk about women throughout our country's history who have tried and failed to become president and what our chances of electing a woman president are in the near future. First, interest rates continue to rise, and that's causing the housing market to cool off from the intense demand it saw for much of the pandemic. Now, some economists say we're in a housing recession, but is that really going to make a difference for people looking to buy, sell, or rent here in Wisconsin? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in the real estate market where you live? Are there fewer for sale signs in the neighborhood these days? Have you been looking to buy or sell a home? How is it going? Any realtors out there, what are you seeing in your line of work in your part of the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right, I'm seeing this phrase thrown around, housing recession. What would that mean? And part two, are we in one?
Well, just like the discussion of the macroeconomy, there are signs that show, yes, we are in a recession, but there is an equal number of data points that show that no, we are not. Right. So in the macroeconomy, we have two successive quarters of negative GDP growth, which is the standard definition of a recession. But unemployment keeps going down and wage growth keeps going up. So that does not look like a recession. So in the housing world, we had three reports recently that all say we're in a housing recession. So the National Association of Home Builders does this forward-looking inventory where they interview their members. And for the first time in years, that turned negative. The National Association of Realtors reports that home sales and home starts, meaning building permits and new construction, those are down. And then Goldman Sachs said we should expect that sales and new construction will also keep going down all the way through 2023. On the other hand, prices are still astronomically high. So even if the rate of growth might have slowed down a little bit in the last couple of months, we're still looking at a housing market that has a lack of inventory, a lack of supply, and high prices. So if you already own your home and don't want to move, things are fine. But if you're looking to move or you're looking to buy for the first time, things are still pretty expensive.
I want to get into some of the factors going on here. Interest rates, we know the Federal Reserve's interest rates, they've been bumping it up. Has that been translating into mortgage interest rates going up?
Yep, absolutely. So if people are interested in tracking mortgage interest rates, Freddie Mac has a great website. And you can see that from January until today, the average 30-year fixed rate mortgage, that's the traditional mortgage that most people have, went from 3.22% to 5.55%. So let's translate that to a person who wanted to buy the median priced house in Wisconsin. That's about a $280,000 house. That means that for the same mortgage, your mortgage payment per month is up over $300 just in the last 6 months. So what that means is for your average home buyer, their purchasing power goes a lot less far because for the same income, you can afford a lower amount of your mortgage because the interest rate is higher. Add that onto the increasing cost of housing, and it's what we call a double whammy. That's a technical term. Your dollar goes less far to buy something that's more expensive.
Okay, but go ahead.
And that's why we see home sales decline and new home starts also decline significantly in the last 6 months relative to 2021, which was a banner year.
Now, last time I talked to you, you were talking about a five-alarm fire when it comes to housing, largely driven by a lot of demand for housing, not a lot of supply for housing. I mean, I don't think those two things have really changed, so wouldn't there be an incentive to still keep building new houses?
There absolutely is an incentive. So maybe we're down to only a four-alarm fire. But here's how it would work. So if you're a current homeowner like me and you're looking to downsize, maybe a condo or a townhouse once the kids leave so you don't have to shovel, you're looking around, and instead of a $300,000 house to buy, that new house is going to cost you $400,000 because of the construction costs. So on the one hand, my purchasing power is down because interest rates are up. So I currently have a good mortgage at less than 3%. To buy a new house, any new home buyer or someone who wants to move, you have to get a new mortgage at the higher rate. So millions of people around the country who might otherwise buy homes are just staying put. And that might mean that there's fewer houses to turn over. So it's again important to say the cost of existing housing will go up when the cost of building new housing goes up. So the cost to build a new home in the last 2 years has gone up at least 37%. So again, instead of a $300,000 house, maybe you're talking about a $400,000 house. So that's just going to lower the number of houses that people can afford to buy. And what I said last time is still true. If we want to bring down the cost of housing, we have to build new housing. But we can't bring down the cost of housing by building new until we can bring down the cost of building new housing. And that's going to take at least 3 to 4 years, I'm guessing, even though we're starting to see some relaxation of the supply chain constraints. Lumber prices are still high. Developers and builders can't get appliances. And what compounds this is a labor shortage. You talk to anyone in construction, they just can't get enough skilled labor to build the houses.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, talking about the housing market in Wisconsin and beyond. A lot going on here as we're hearing mortgage rates going up. Prices still staying pretty high, but maybe there's a housing recession where I'm building new houses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll love to hear from people who build houses or would build houses if you could find people to build them and stuff to build them with. What are you seeing out there? If you are buying, selling, or making a very conscious decision to stay put, maybe until things settle down, love to hear your story. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt, I know an ongoing concern of yours and something you research is the idea of workplace housing. If I want to work in this community and I want to live in or at least close to this community, can I find a place to live there? What are you seeing going on around Wisconsin now?
So as you point out, if you have a job opening, if you're an employer or a county economic development official, and you have jobs opening, but you have no housing or the housing that is available is extremely expensive, it's very hard to recruit workers to come to your area. I'm sure you've seen the news recently. Sheboygan County had 3,000 jobs open, and their housing vacancy rate is close to zero. So they, even if they could get people to move there, there's nowhere for them to live. And this just makes it harder to recruit and retain your workforce. And it also means that if people feel stuck, so they want to stay in their current house, then maybe they don't have the capacity to move one county over or move to another state for perhaps a better job opportunity. So it works both against employers being able to recruit, but also for job seekers to be able to move.
Is there a creative solution if I'm, you know, in planning in Sheboygan County, or if I'm an employer in Sheboygan County, I'd sure like to bring those workers in and find them a place to live. And I don't want to wait 3 hours or 3 years, I'm sorry, for the price of lumber to come down. Is there something I could do in the short run?
Well, there's not a lot you can do in the short run, because even if you waved a magic wand and got zoning approval to build lots of housing and new single family homes, those would take 18 months to build. You can't get the labor. So the creative solutions are factory built housing or manufactured housing, which we can deliver. But even those are subject to production delays. So one of the interesting things Sheboygan County is doing is they're just deciding to get into the housing business themselves and build some units themselves. But again, it takes financing and it takes construction and it takes time.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. James is with us here in Wisconsin. James, hi.
Hello. Yeah, my opinion on this thing is, well, when you're paying, you know, for example, $15 an hour to work at McDonald's, what does that do to the cost of labor for skilled laborers? I know people right now that are roofing that won't get on top of a roof for under $40 an hour. And it's been quite ridiculous, some of the prices of labor, what people expect now. So these people with the skilled labor are looking for other work.
And James, do you work in construction trades yourself?
I've been in construction my entire life, and I thoroughly enjoy it. It just doesn't pay like it used to. You know, $20 an hour, $25 an hour, 10, 15 years ago, it used to be a good wage. And nowadays, it just isn't. You're just not going to get a labor force for that kind of money.
James, thanks a lot for sharing that firsthand example. Kurt, this is part of the labor costs you were talking about earlier.
Exactly. And as James knows, if you have to pay $40 for a roofer instead of $20, and you have to pay for your framers and your HVAC people, in addition, even if you could get the materials at the same price, a 20 or 30% increase in labor, that's going to drive up the cost of an average house $30,000 to $40,000. So here again, we think that high wages is generally good, particularly for workers. But if we want to deliver housing at a lower price point, then something has to give. Either the cost of materials has to go down, or the cost of land and infrastructure has to go down, or the cost of labor has to go down. And none of those are easy levers to maneuver in the short run to affect our housing prices.
Thanks for that call, James. We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about what's going on in the housing market a lot and whether we're in a housing recession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in development, realty, related fields, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're in the market to sell or buy a house, or maybe putting that on hold for a while, tell us your story. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about a housing recession, maybe, in the United States right now, and what's going on in the housing scene here in Wisconsin. Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Kim is with us in near Madison. Kim, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a property manager in the Madison and surrounding areas. Last year, we built a 57-unit building, and now I'm just finishing up a construction of a 37-unit. And I tell you, the costs have more than tripled. You know, it's tough to, as a landlord and watching these owners, you know, afford it and then make affordable housing for our renters. And I also want to curtail that. I agree 100%. Trying to find a vendor, getting appliances, everything is just an incredible struggle right now. And I this is a good topic because it needs to be addressed.
Kim, thanks for that call, Kim. Kurt, a lot of times if you can't buy a house, you rent a house. Well, Kim says same factors are driving up the cost of rent too.
Exactly, right? And we have two forces also driving up rents. In the first instance, as Kim pointed out, to build new rental housing is also 35 to 40% more expensive just on the input costs. So either you don't build that housing because you can no longer make that project cash flow, or you have to raise the rents to cover the additional costs. And as you pointed out, there's a large number of potential home buyers who have stayed in the rental market because they can no longer afford an entry-level home or they can't save for the down payment. So they stay in rental markets, which puts pressure on rents. So nationwide, rents have grown more than 10% year over year in the last couple of months. And we would expect that you're going to have continued strong rent growth and rental demand because of the factors we talked about earlier. That means that for your lower wage workers or people at the lower end of the wage scale, you are seeing your rents go up 10 or 15%, which is a real problem for affordability because your income has not gone up 10 or 15%. We say that in a housing market, all of the bad stuff trickles down to the lower end of the wage scale. So renters who make less than $15 an hour are really stressed right now.
Thanks for the call, Kim. Cheryl joins us next in Rice Lake. Cheryl, hello.
Hello. So my mentioned about housing being available in the cities, you know, won't even bring a person in because there's no place to go. We have the same situation in Rice Lake. And what our situation, actually what I see locally, is our housing is getting snatched up by people who are using it for short-term rental or vacation property.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. You hear that in big cities sometimes, Kurt. I've heard it in places like Door County and other places that rely on tourism a lot. People can't afford to live there, they say, because the Airbnbs and VRBOs are owners are buying things up.
Right. Or we see investors buying housing to turn it into rental for long-term rental. And again, in a really tight housing market, when you have institutional actors or Airbnbs or bulk purchasers, even 1% or 2% of the market, you can really constrain supply and availability. And so a first-time home buyer who might be using something like FHA or a Veterans Administration loan, you're going to be outcompeted by someone who's going to be an all-cash buyer without contingencies. So again, the long-run solution is to build more housing so that there's more competition with Airbnb and investor-owned single family. But in the short run, that's really putting a price pressure in our markets, as Cheryl pointed out.
Thanks for the call, Cheryl. Steber joins us now in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi.
What
my comment is simply that a lot of people don't want 2,000, 3,000 square foot houses, but the builders only want to build big houses because they make more money. I had a little bitty job to do this summer, but it was too little. So I'm doing it myself.
Wow. Thanks for the call. Kurt, is this a problem we don't have? It's not just we don't have enough housing. We don't have like the size people want, say, like you were talking about earlier, if somebody wants to downsize after the kids go.
Yes, exactly. We don't build a lot of the smaller houses on smaller lots or the attached housing like a townhouse or a duplex, which would really meet that entry-level price point, that first-time homebuyer price point, or move-down housing for seniors. So again, if a senior moves out of a large single-family house into a condo or a townhouse, then they recycle that larger home for young families. But I want to disagree at least half of what she said, that I don't think it's the fact that builders only want to build large, expensive homes. I think it's also driven by zoning. If the zoning ordinance says you can only build a single family house on a large lot, like 10,000 square feet, then your land costs and your infrastructure costs are so high that the only way a developer can make a reasonable return is to build a large home with high-end finishings to pay for those land and infrastructure costs. So if cities were to allow a much larger supply of townhouses, small lot houses, maybe duplexes or houses closer together, I think you would see many developers who want to build at that affordable, smaller price point. But obviously what we've talked about earlier, you're still not going to build anything affordable, even if it's a small house on a small lot, as long as construction costs are as high as they are right now.
Thanks for that call. Kurt, one thing I've seen is some cities have tackled their zoning. I think Minneapolis is one, some on the West Coast, to try to allow more for, you know, the so-called mother-in-law suite or something like that. You know, a separate unit, maybe it's an attic unit or an outbuilding on a house. Do you see those making a difference in housing supply and maybe in the future bringing the cost down?
Yes, but that will take a long time, and that's a small portion of the market. So again, if you look at a city like Madison, which is making it easier to build those accessory dwelling units, that will relax some of the supply constraints just a little bit. But in a really tight market like we have in Madison, it's not going to have a whole lot of impact on price. But again, as you pointed out, we want to create not just different prices, but a different variety of housing to meet the needs of all different family sizes and age groups. And so anything we can do to relax the housing supply will help us over the long run to bring down the cost of housing. But nobody expects that the median price of a single family house is going to fall all that much, even if you drastically increase supply, just because we continue to have very strong demand for housing.
And just our last half a minute, Kurt, what is the biggest open question on your mind right now when it comes to housing?
Well, if I was really smart and could forecast where housing would go, I would invest one side or the other. I think house prices are going to stay high for the next 5 years. And it has this ratchet effect where until you can bring down the cost of new construction and significantly deliver lots of new housing, you're going to continue to have entry-level homeownership affordability challenges and a real stress on the rental market. And absent some major new federal policy, sorry to end on bad news, but I think things will get a little bit worse before they get better.
Kurt, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. He was with us today to talk about housing in the United States, whether we're in a housing recession and why that doesn't mean housing prices, he says, are likely to come down anytime soon. Only 22 women have run for president in the United States. And that's counting at least one who wasn't that serious about it. Comedian Gracie Allen announcing her 1940 campaign here with George Burns.
George, I'll let you in on a secret. I'm running for president.
You're running for president?
Yes.
Gracie, how long has this been going on?
Well, 450 years. George Washington started it.
But in the entire history of the United States, there's never been a woman president.
Well, yeah, isn't that exciting? I'll be the first one. Vote for Gracie.
Oh, Gracie, what do you mean?
That was a publicity stunt at the time. But over 80 years later, there's still never been a woman president of the United States. There have been very serious campaigns, though, by women running for the White House in recent years, six of them in the 2020 election alone. Our next guest covered the 2016 and 2020 elections and spent a lot of time with many of those women running for the White House. She wanted to dig into why none of these women have broken through that presidential glass ceiling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we haven't had a woman as president yet? Did you have a favorite candidate or a dream candidate maybe who hasn't even run? Tell us about that preference and why. Do you think that the deck is stacked in some ways against women who might want to run for the White House? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ali Vitale is an NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent. Her new book is called Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. Ali, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. So excited to be with you.
As I mentioned, you've covered a lot of presidential candidates, many of them women. What led you to tackle this issue, this theme in your new book?
Well, I continuously found myself drawn to female candidates. That's even true when I'm at my day job at the U.S. Capitol, where I am now. So any of the echoes or bings of the of the empty U.S. Capitol, that's the explanation for it. But for me, I was always drawn to these women in part because they were trying to do something that had never been done before. But also because myself, as a woman, I was able to see some of these more misogynistic stereotypes and tropes being applied to them. And my hope was that I could disrupt those narratives before they started. And that's also my hope for the book, is that in walking through moments from the 2020 campaign that many of us all just lived through or followed, or in my case, in your case, reported on, going back through those moments and applying a gender lens to them and being able to explain, yes, the politics of those moments, but also the unquantifiable impact of gender.
One big issue that comes up again and again in your reporting in the book with a bunch of women running in the Democratic primary, this idea of electability. And I want, there's a common mindset among voters, maybe politicians and others who think, okay, I personally, they might say, would happily vote for a woman, but all those other people won't. That's going to hurt us in the general election. So maybe I don't vote for a woman in the primary. Could you talk about that hurdle to overcome?
That is one of the key things that I was hearing in real time as I was traveling the country, both in 2016 and again in 2020, this doubt of whether a woman could ultimately clear this final hurdle. And that's something that in 2016, the question was answered for the country, which is that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and it answers the question of whether or not the country was ready to elect a female president. It turns out they were, just not by the metric that we actually elect presidents by, which of course is the Electoral College. And then in 2020, it became the question to ask the female candidates was, how do you do something that has never been done before? And I think that one of the important things that I point to in the book is it's not patently unfair to ask if this candidate can win. It's a question that voters apply to both men and women who are trying to run for office. Everyone wants to be able to pick a winner. But at the same time, for the women, it was always a question of who are we giving the benefit of the doubt to? And generally speaking, voters seemed a little bit more ready to give the benefit of the doubt of winning to a man, especially when Donald Trump was introduced to the picture. I think one of the striking things was I spoke with many of the women who ran in 2020 and in 2016 for this book, everyone from Carly Fiorina, who was the only woman on the 2016 Republican side, to Secretary Hillary Clinton herself. And many of them point to the fact that Trump was a complicating factor for an already complicated quest of being the first female president.
Now, you noted in the book, 1978, that's the first year that we have a woman elected to the U.S. Senate who wasn't a spouse of the previous holder of that seat. We had Geraldine Ferraro running for vice president in 1984. Now it seems like, at least in some ways, in the primary campaigns, the dam is breaking. You mentioned Carly Fiorina, Michelle Bachmann on the Republican side, Sarah Palin, of course, vice presidential nominee, this bunch of women. So it does seem like the tide is slowly turning here.
It's turning in a few different ways. I think that the pipeline right now of qualified, viable women is so much fuller on both sides. And that's a really good progress point, especially as you look ahead to future election cycles, where I really do believe that we are done with the days of only white men running for president in both primary fields, Republican and Democrat. The caveat, of course, is that 2024 itself is right now governed by two older white men, because Joe Biden is the president of the United States and he says he's going to run for president again. And Donald Trump is the former president of the United States, and he says he's going to run again. Nevertheless, it does seem like there's progress being made both in the pipeline, but then also you speak to the idea of Geraldine Ferraro being the first female vice presidential nominee on the Democratic side, Sarah Palin many years later in 2008 with John McCain. The thing that both of those nominations have in common is the fact that both of the campaigns that chose the female running mates were kind of at a low point for them. Polling wise, they were lacking energy. It was sort of a throw spaghetti at the wall and see what can energize the electorate move. In 2020, Joe Biden, at the apex of his political power, knew that it would be an asset to have a woman on the ticket with him, and ultimately chose Kamala Harris. And that in and of itself is a major shift from the other moments when we've seen women nominated as vice presidential contenders, because this was something where Biden was saying, having a woman on the ticket is an asset. It's not just something that I hope might work to gin up the base.
Ali Vitale is with us, NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent, joining us from the Capitol. We're talking about her new book. It's called Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. The media, Ali, how did you see, as you went through this 2020 campaign in particular, how did you see the media, maybe the media is a big word, but in general, the media treating those women running for the Democratic nomination versus the men running for that same nomination?
Well, look, I think that part of what I do in the book as a member of the media, which is a big word, but it counts, especially in terms of who's following these candidates around on the campaign trail from Iowa to New Hampshire and everywhere in between, is it's in the questions that we ask. And one of the things that I talked about with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, for example, was we had a tendency to ask these female candidates, do you think that you can win and make history? Which the framing of that question innately puts these candidates on the defensive. But the other piece of this too, and thankfully, I think most reporters had been trained out of this line of thinking over the course of the preceding presidentials, was the idea of likability. It's certainly a metric that was applied to Hillary Clinton in 2008 and again in 2016, but it was still something that even if we weren't asking directly about likability, I think likability got put into play as electability and became sort of its own gendered metric, even as people wised up to the fact that talking about candidates being likable really only cut against women. I do think that there's certainly progress that needs to be made. And one of the things that I say in the book is that having more women and people of color in newsrooms and in press corps on the campaign trail makes it so that more candidates' lived experiences can be highlighted and can be seen as authentic and can be explained and contextualized in the right way. But I do still think that there's progress to be made on that front as well, needing more diversity in newsrooms and needing to amplify more voices that are not just straight, white, and male, which is the typical lens that news media tends to come through still.
You followed Senator Elizabeth Warren a lot on the campaign trail. I want to give a listen to Senator Warren in January of 2020, not long before she ended up dropping out of the race, talking about this question of whether a woman could win. Here's a listen.
The world has changed since 2016. Once Donald Trump was inaugurated, you may remember what happened the very next day. Biggest protest rally in the history of the world. Women turned out and said, wow, I'm going to get deeper into politics. So what happened? In 2018, we took back the House. We took back state houses around this country. Why? Because of women candidates and women who got out to support and help make sure that Democrats got elected. What the data show are that women candidates have been outperforming men candidates in competitive elections since Donald Trump was elected. Let's face it, women win.
2018, she mentioned. You also talked to a Republican organizing group that saw some successes for Republican women going into Congress. There, at least some parts of both parties are putting a focus, maybe not at the presidential level, but in Congress. What did we see?
Well, it starts in Congress, right? It starts in Congress. It starts in state houses, mayoral races, gubernatorial races. That's the way that these parties fill the pipeline. And look, Elizabeth, Senator Warren is right in that women have been winning at the same or greater rates than men when they run. And part of the reason why I focus on the primary so much in this book is because it's primary elections, not general elections, where you see gender and race most at play and most at risk of harming female or person of color candidacies. And so that's why it's so important in this book to focus on the primary perspective here. But look, 2018, I think, was a moment in most recent memory for Democrats of seeing major gains made in the House from women and people of color candidates. And then again in 2020, Republicans were able to make significant gains, especially in highly contested, closely watched seats and races, in part because they put forward good, strong candidates who were women. And so what one Republican organizer and operative told me is that 2020 was a proof point for a party, the Republican Party, that does not like to put gender first, does not like to campaign identity forward. That's something that the conservative grassroots typically balk at and candidates are very aware of. But at the same time, the party apparatus saw the return on investment of good, strong female candidates. That is not to say, and I think there's an interesting thing happening on the Republican side of this right now, is that Republican women like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert are exactly the kind of candidates who are doing very well on the fringe of the Republican Party. It makes sense as to why, because they are trying to prove their ideological credentials and fealty to Trump. But what several Republican operatives have said to me is that because of the rise of those kinds of candidates, they have also felt the need to qualify the kind of Republican woman that they will support, which is to say they've added disclaimers on their websites that they support qualified female candidates, not candidates who trade in conspiracy theories and other things like we see from the far right of the party right now.
We're talking to NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Ali Vitale about her new book, Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. if you are a woman yourself, is it important to you to have a woman become a president in your lifetime in the next 4 to 8 years? Why or why not? And for anybody out there who struck you as a great candidate among the women who ran in the last 8 or 10 years in their respective primaries, who would you like to see run? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Ali Vitale, NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent, looking at her new book. It's called Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a woman as president of the United States in the next X number of years? Is this something that's important to you? Women out there listening, is this something you've been hoping to see in your lifetime? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Eric is with us in Hazel Green. Eric, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to mention that I'm actually old enough to be one of the small amount of voters who voted for Geraldine Ferraro, Mondale Ferraro. And over my years, I was at one time a Republican, and I was hoping that Condoleezza Rice would have run. She is someone I really would have voted for.
Eric, thanks for that call. We actually heard from Joel on Facebook, who also put in a vote for Condoleezza Rice for the first woman president. She is somebody much talked about, I think, Ali, but never actually took the plunge.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But that's not to say that Republicans aren't going to have good female options, I think. If I'm sort of looking into my presidential crystal ball, as I sometimes like to do, there's clearly a pile of talent on the conservative side of this. People like former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, as well as South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. And then, of course, you think, for example, of Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who has all but said that she's actively thinking about a presidential run. Hers, of course, is meant to prevent Donald Trump from getting another term. But I think that Republican leadership right now has a lot of women swelling in their ranks. Even if I think about in the halls of Congress, you have Elise Stefanik, who took Cheney's place in Republican leadership here. So certainly over the course of the last few years, there is a good group of women who are coming up who could mount viable presidential campaigns on the other side. Though, I don't know, I can't speak for Condoleezza Rice, but of course, it makes sense why people might put her in that mix as well as someone who they would like to see run, given her experience on the world stage as well.
Thanks for that call. And Ali, you talk about in your book, like historically in a lot of other countries, the first woman prime minister or president or whatever was often on the conservative side. And you heard a prediction possibly even from Hillary Clinton, who said she didn't like it, but she thought there was a decent chance that the first woman president might be a Republican.
That's exactly right. Somewhat surprising, but of course, Clinton was very quick to clarify with me that she doesn't want to see a conservative woman get there first, but that history tells us that that's something that has happened time and again. And I think the other thing to think about here when you consider why the U.S. hasn't elected a female president yet is the system by which we do it. We talked earlier in our conversation about the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but not the Electoral College. If you look at other countries, England, for example, women tend to do well in parliamentary systems, places where they're elected to a governing body and then elevated by their peers as the head of that governing body. Of course, if that were the way that the U.S. did it, we would have a prime minister or a President Nancy Pelosi already, but that's obviously not the U.S. system.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pam is with us in Oconto. Pam, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I very, very much think that we're behind the times by not having put a female in office as president. You look at other industrialized countries, and they've had women in office that have done wonderfully. Women are great multitaskers, and I do feel that we have some very strong women in politics that would be wonderful presidents. One of them, I think, is Liz Cheney. She is very intelligent. She knows the law. She follows the law. And I think that she would be a great president for our country.
Pam, thanks a lot for the call. Ali, run with that where you want to go. Are you there, Ali? I think we've lost.
Yes, hi.
Oh,
I am
there
here.
You are. Okay.
No, I'm here. despite multiple years of the pandemic, the mute button is still elusive to me, apparently.
We've all been there. Some of us earlier today, for that matter.
Oh, good. I'm not alone. But look, I think that what your caller says makes a lot of sense, especially at this moment where on the conservative side of the spectrum, you have sort of the accountability movement of former President Donald Trump being led in large part by women, not just Vice Chair Liz Cheney in her role on the January 6th committee, but also in the former members of Trump's administration, Cassidy Hutchinson, Sarah Matthews, who came forward to testify. And then if you look at the state level, who's doing these investigations, you have the Attorney General in the state of New York, as well as the DA in Fulton County, both women. And so they are very much at the forefront of the conversation around the former president and accountability. That's one of the key pieces. And then, you know, if you look on the Democratic side of things, we haven't yet talked about the fact that Vice President Kamala Harris is historic. Although it's not a woman in the Oval Office as president, she has risen further than any woman has before. The first woman and person of color in that role. It's extremely impactful. And in my conversations with both Republican and Democratic operatives, everyone agrees that having Kamala Harris in that position does make the road a little bit smoother for anyone who might come after her. Because all of this, at the end of the day, is about imagination. It's asking voters to imagine a woman in the White House. And that's an extra step that male candidates don't have to go through. Yes, they're asking voters to imagine them, that individual, whoever they are, as president. But women candidates have to take it a step further. And having Kamala Harris there in a high-ranking executive role allows a little bit less imagination at play and a little bit more ability for the country to realize what it would look like to have a woman in those spaces. And it's not just a question of representation mattering, though certainly I've heard that from women across the country, but it's also a question of what kind of policy gets pushed to the fore. The fact that the White House, for example, is focusing so heavily right now on reproductive access, on Black maternal mortality, those are things that Kamala Harris has been key in keeping at the forefront of the conversation.
Time for one more caller. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
Yeah, so this might be a bit of a silly or redundant question. It maybe has already been addressed on this program, but one of the questions that really stuck with me is, what's the best way for, I guess, women and Black and brown candidates to win primaries, like, you know, whether it's presidential or gubernatorial or Senate primaries, like, what's the most efficient and I guess also safest way for them to win those primaries without having to focus too intensely on their identities or having to prove themselves otherwise?
Jack, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Allie, you gave an example of Kristi Noem and how she framed some of those things, addressing gender without putting it, I don't know. She had this interesting needle threading you talk about.
And that's something that you see on the Republican side a lot, but it is something that it depends which party you're running in. And I really do think that it's part of your identity. You show up how you show up. At a certain point, you're going to have to talk about gender and your lived experience because people want to get to know their candidates. But at the end of the day, that's not the only thing that these women bring to the table. And you see them clearing qualification metrics time and again. And I talk about the politics in the book, too, because I'm a political reporter first. I love political campaigns, but that's also part of this picture.
Jack, thanks for the call. And Allie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Allie Vitale is an NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your nominations, on the Ideas Network Facebook page.